Good morning. Our third and last case on the oral argument calendar this morning, the State v. Sargent. Each side will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask that each counsel identify themselves for the record before they begin their presentation. Ms. Lawler, you may commence.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Amy Lawler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Sargent, in this appeal. There are two issues within this restitution appeal, one relating to the personal items taken from the car, and the second relating to alleged damage committed against the car. And I'm going to start with the second first in light of the recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision that just came out this past week, State v. Boettcher. And that case directly related to the question of whether or not an individual could be required to pay restitution for a count alleging damage for which he was not convicted. And the court resolved that question and cleared up any ambiguity that may have been laid in the decisions in Nelson and its progeny back in 2011. And specifically held that because Nelson allowed criminal restitution for losses that merely have a factual relationship to the defendant's crime, it's in direct conflict with existing law, and to the extent that it is in conflict, it is overruled. And that matters particularly in this case here, because Mr. Sargent pled guilty to taking some of his friend's personal items from his car, welding equipment and the like. He did not admit to stealing a car or to damaging a car. And that becomes crucial even in a case like this, in which it was a guilty plea to one count where the other counts were dismissed, because the Boettcher court addressed that as well. And in footnote 5 said that this applies and that the Nelson analysis applies, and that it is only not touching situations where there's an agreement within guilty plea cases, as laid out in State v. Kennedy, in which the defendant agrees to pay restitution for losses to a victim in exchange for dismissal of charges. That was not the case here. Mr. Sargent has always denied that he stole the vehicle and that he damaged the vehicle. There was never any plea agreement that he would pay restitution in exchange for dismissal of the count alleging the theft. There was never any agreement that he would pay restitution with respect to the car at all.
Ms. Lawler,
and so,
Ms. Lawler, on that point, I'm looking at the Monoman County Attorney's Office letter of November 19, 2017, which it was incorporated in the file and in the judge's order, and specifically listed in terms of the agreement is pay restitution to the victim, parentheses with the S, so that would imply either individually or more than one person, and it references the file 170634. So would that not be an agreement to pay restitution?
I don't think it's an agreement to pay restitution on the dismissed count or in exchange for the dismissal of the account. The restitution agreement didn't specify, and you're right, it doesn't specify whether there is one victim or whether there's more than one victim. It leaves the possibility open that there's one or more than one. It also leaves open the possibility that of the personal items that were taken from the car, some belonged to Mr. Haugland and some belonged to Ms. Panger. But that agreement does not specify that there is any agreement to pay restitution in exchange for the dismissal of a count. And it doesn't show that there is an agreement to pay restitution for any alleged theft of a car or damage to a car.
So if Mr. Haugland had been the one to file the affidavit, or if he, so two scenarios, if he had been the one to file the affidavit saying those were my belongings, they're gone, would we be here?
We would, because there would still be an additional question of hearsay and confrontation if he had not shown up to the restitution hearing. If he had made that affidavit and then gone to the restitution hearing and offered non-hearsay testimony, I don't think we would be here. And so that directly relates to this, the portion of the restitution order that deals with alleged damage to the car. And if you look at the district court's restitution order at the bottom of page 4, there's a line that says the damage to the vehicle occurred as part of the same incident as the theft of personal property. So that language is very clearly covered by the Supreme Court's analysis in Boettcher. The district court here applied the analysis that now, following the Supreme Court's decision in Boettcher, is simply not allowed because it conflicts with the very clear precedent that you only get restitution ordered on crimes where you've been convicted of the crime or where you specifically agree to pay restitution on a dismissed count in exchange for the dismissal. That didn't happen here. And so to the extent that the district court's order ordered restitution in the amount of alleged damage to the car, in this case, Ms. Panger claims essentially total loss of the car, that restitution order must be vacated. That then leaves the remaining issues, the theft of personal property and the question of whether or not the district court erred in ordering Mr. Sargent to pay the cost of the alleged loss of all of the personal property in the car when it was claimed by someone who never actually claimed she owned those items and also was claimed by someone who didn't then go to the restitution hearing. And that raises a number of problems because under Minnesota's restitution scheme, it's essentially a multi-part process in which the burden shifts back and forth between the parties depending on the phase. So it starts with the plea hearing where here, page 13 and 14, Mr. Sargent admits only to taking personal property from the car and indicates that the property is Mr. Hoglund's. Then Ms. Panger submitted an affidavit, which under 611A04 subdivision 1A begins the process. Then the burden shifted back to Mr. Sargent to file an affidavit contesting the amount and requesting the hearing, as he did pursuant to 611A045 subdivision 3B. And then we reach the third phase, the contested hearing. And that's where the burden then shifts back to the state under 611A045 subdivision 3A. And there the state had the burden to introduce the evidence pursuant to the rules of evidence to meet its burden to prove that there was a victim who suffered specific losses as a result of Mr. Sargent's crime. And the rules of evidence here are particularly important. The Minnesota Supreme Court decision, Willis, that definitively decided that the rules of evidence apply to these restitution hearings was decided almost a year before the restitution hearing in this case was held. And everyone at the hearing noted that it was unusual. Even the judge pointed out that he's never had one like this before, where the state showed up and said it simply wanted to rest on the affidavit. But there's the problem with that is that these restitution hearings require a trial-like confrontation that was established in Maddox that was reiterated in Willis. And Willis made very clear that the rules of evidence apply in terms of the evidence that the state is introducing to meet its burden. Here, the state didn't introduce any evidence that would have been admissible. It relied on that affidavit, which began the restitution process, but it didn't offer any evidence that would be admissible to meet its burden at the trial-like confrontation of the restitution hearing. It rested on an affidavit that was hearsay, prepared for litigation, but the state had, once it offered that, offered no additional evidence, offered no witnesses, and even at one point seemed to back off its request and asked the court simply to award $1,001 because obviously if you're convicted under that statute, you must have stolen it. So the restitution hearing was quite short. The transcript spans 7 pages. And nowhere in that time did the state offer any evidence that would be admissible to meet its burden in the trial-like confrontation required under these restitution hearings. And I think the Boettcher decision, when it was going through all of the analysis about why you have to really limit the amount of restitution ordered to those crimes that the individual was convicted of committing, specifically references the fact that it goes through the statutory obligations, and this is at star 3 of the decision, laying out under 611A01B defining victim, then under 04 subdivision 1A stating that victims may request restitution, and then under 045 subdivision 1A1 requiring the court to determine the amount of restitution, and finally under 3A putting the burden of demonstrating the amount of loss on the prosecution. And so Boettcher really reiterated that this is a process in which step by step by step, you end at that confrontation, that trial-like confrontation in which the prosecution bears the burden. And here there's no question that this evidence that was admitted, this affidavit, was hearsay. There was no exception to the hearsay rules that would apply. And additionally, it deprived Mr. Sargent of the ability to confront the witness against him. So all the defendant could do is say, we don't believe that any of the losses claimed were Ms. Panger's. It couldn't do anything else because it couldn't cross-examine her and it couldn't cross-examine Mr. Haugland. There was no one there that they could ask about these alleged losses or ask her to provide in any detail why she believed any of the, for example, the welding equipment was hers or belonged to her. They couldn't ask her whether or not, as Mr. Sargent believed, some of the items were Mr. Haugland's outright and some had been a gift to him. They couldn't do any of the things required under a trial like confrontation because there was no one there to confront, because the state didn't present a case, it didn't offer witnesses, and it didn't introduce any evidence that would survive any test of admissibility under the hearsay rules or the confrontation clause.
Ms. Lawler, is it true that the appellant did not object? And assuming that's the case, would we use the plain error analysis, and how would you recommend that analysis be resolved?
It is true that they didn't offer a clear objection, and so yes, I do think that you need to use the plain error analysis as we laid out in our brief. We agree that both under the hearsay issue and under the confrontation clause issue, the plain error test should apply. At the same time, though, there's a complete and clear record for this court to review on both of those issues, where the defense repeatedly raises the problem, well, there's nothing here. There's no witness. There's nothing for us to do. And then in the memoranda that both sides submitted following the hearing, reiterated those arguments. So here, where the state's entirety of its argument, and it bears the burden of showing the victim's loss, it's resting its entire case on an inadmissible affidavit that would not be admissible under the rules of hearsay or under the confrontation clause. That is a quintessential plain error, because without that affidavit, there is nothing for the state to rely on to meet its burden, and there's nothing that would support then the district court's ultimate decision to award restitution. Unless the court has any additional questions, we would simply ask the court to reverse on both of those issues, one in light of Boettcher and the other in light of the inadmissibility under the hearsay rules and under Crawford of the affidavit that underlied the entirety of the district court's affidavit order.
All right, thank you.
Restitution order.
Thank you, Ms. Lawler. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, my name is John Olson. I'm Assistant County Attorney for Mahnomen County. I'm here representing the state of Minnesota in this matter. I'm going to maybe start with addressing maybe some of the arguments put by Ms. Lawler in the order, and probably start out with some of the factual issues regarding the ownership of the property.
Well, I would like it if you would start your argument with how what happened at the district court complied with Minnesota Statute 611A.045.
Okay, Your Honor. I was not involved at the trial court level, so I'm going to do the best I can with the record that's available. Of course, on appeal, that's all anyone has in any event. Mr. Sargent was charged with three separate counts, two related to the theft of the motor vehicle, and then one for the property inside the vehicle. He pled guilty to that charge. I believe it was count one, and then the remaining two were dismissed as part of a plea agreement. He was given an executed sentence, as I understand it. Following sentencing, Kathleen Panger submitted an affidavit for restitution seeking $2,095. The losses in the affidavit stem from property in the vehicle and some expenses regarding damage to the vehicle and recovering of the motor vehicle. About a month later, following her affidavit, the defendant, Tyler Sargent, filed a contrary affidavit saying he disputes it. In there was a very vague and general assertion saying she doesn't own the property. He provided no specifics, the basis for that. And so we're just taking it on speculation.
Counsel?
There's nothing on the record as far as the ownership of the property.
I think you're kind of getting to the problem that at least I see, and that is that the court here made some statements that appeared to reflect confusion over the burden, the respective burdens of the parties here. And the comment about it is entirely possible that Ms. Pinger owned all or some of the property, personal property, and then it seems to shift the burden onto the appellant here to show that she was not the owner. You want to address that?
I can, to the best I can, Your Honor. So she submitted an affidavit, and I pulled that out, and she says, I, Kathleen Pinger, state the following: losses were incurred. And so I think it's one can conclude reading the affidavit that she was the one who incurred the losses. I think there was some supposition in the record that she might not have owned them. I don't think the court was entirely sure about it, but I think what happened is they said, well, she submitted the affidavit, therefore we're going to conclude that. And since he did nothing to really counter that other than a vague general assertion, they were just going to rely on the affidavit, which was the sworn statement. And there was really nothing of specificity countering that affidavit. He didn't provide any testimony explaining the basis for his views or anything. And he was, I believe, as I understand it, present. He sure could have if he wanted to.
But how does that comply with the rules of evidence that are applicable to trials and hearings like this?
Well, there's no question that the decision of State v. Willis was in place before this decision. And that decision in Willis did interpret Rule 111, 1101 is not covering restitution hearings, where it said the rules of evidence don't apply to sentencing. In other words, the rules of evidence do apply to restitution. Our argument and the state's position here is that because Minnesota Statute 611.04 specifically says, and so it says the court or its designee shall obtain the information from the victim in affidavit form or by other competent evidence. So the state's position here is because the statute in question governing the procedure defines that affidavit as competent evidence, the affidavit can be considered.
But only if the defendant doesn't oppose it pursuant to the statute.
Well,
which happened here. I mean, it's not illogical for Mr. Sargent to contest whether or not a 68-year-old woman owns a crutch welding helmet, Red Wing steel toe boots, a welding jacket, welding gloves, and safety glasses, and a brush hammer for welding.
I understand the issue that he would maybe question whether that were hers, but she did submit the affidavit there, and he didn't provide anything specific. And so our position is where that's not countered, the court may consider the affidavit, and that's distinct from the Willis situation where that was a letter from the victim's attorney indicating how much legal fees were incurred as far as clearing up title of the property following a forged quitclaim deed. And so because the legislature uses and defined that affidavit as competent evidence, the court may consider that where there's nothing specifically contradicting it. And part of that argument is based on our rules of statutory construction, where we read statutes that no language is rendered superfluous. And if we're going to say that the affidavit cannot be considered, it's merely a request form, that language saying competent evidence is rendered almost meaningless.
Well, I'm
so that's
looking at 611A.045 subdivision 3, which says that the burden of production must include a detailed sworn affidavit of the offender setting forth all challenges to the restitution or items of restitution. And I don't know why saying I contest that Ms. Panger owned these items, and it goes on to include Under Armour sweatshirts, Minnesota Wild sweatshirt, Air Force black tennies, those sorts of things. I don't know why that's not specific enough then to shift the burden back at, and this is the last sentence of that subdivision, the burden of demonstrating the amount of loss sustained by a victim as a result of the offense is on the prosecution. And that's where the hearing comes in the rules of evidence.
Well, Your Honor, as far as his the defendant sergeant's affidavit, he just makes a general searching. He doesn't address any specific items. He just says, specifically, items recovered, and page one of his affidavit, paragraph four, says specifically the items recovered from the vehicle, including clothing, property, tires, rims, etc., are not recoverable by Ms. Panger as they were not her personal property. He doesn't say what the basis for that is, and it's something anyone can say, and it's hard to maybe refute. It's, I think the court, when analyzing the statement, treated it as just a general assertion and nothing more. He was at the hearing and could have refuted it.
But he doesn't have to. The burden is on the state at that point.
Well, and
As I read the statute.
Well, Ms. Lawler probably made a pretty correct analysis that there's maybe a burden shifting. First, it's on the party seeking the restitution, then it's on the defendant, and then it shifts back. And I think our issue is that he didn't do enough there to overcome that. Just a general assertion is almost more like an answer in a civil claim saying, I make a general denial, but it doesn't do much more than that. And it says a detailed sworn, and it wasn't detailed. It just said, I don't think they're her property. And there was nothing in the record contradicting that. I'm going to address maybe just a few other points. Finally, would probably be the last argument, which is there was two different charges in a plea of guilty on one charge and a dismissal. And I think our argument is rest upon primarily on the case of State v. Olson. Now, Ms. Lawler referenced a case I was not familiar with, and so I'm unable to make an argument there as how that would be implicated. But State v. Olson involves someone who was convicted of burglary but acquitted of the theft. Both, there was money stolen in the building, and the court affirmed restitution because it all resulted in the same behavioral incident. And that's really the situation we have here. When you take a car, when you have stuff in it, you can't really do one without the other. And so it's all a part of a single act of him taking the vehicle, which inevitably is the contents. So we believe State v. Olson allows us to seek restitution for all the items that were taken, including the recovery of the car. The other concern here is the Confrontation Clause right, and Ms. Lawler references the decision in State v. Maddox, which actually covers the right of counsel to be present at the hearing, and I believe. And what the court's language there was, the defendant in contesting restitution must engage in a confrontation-like. Nothing in that opinion suggests that the Sixth Amendment confrontation right specifically applies. And in our brief, we've covered numerous opinions from almost every circuit and a few state courts that have all affirmed Crawford and versus Washington, and the resulting decisions do not apply to post-sentencing or post-sentencing related matters. They only apply to the adjudication of guilt or innocence. And I can't find any precedent anywhere that says anything to the contrary. So unless there's further questions, probably on those points, I will rest. Finally, I think the position of us is with the Willis application of Willis is I don't believe there is plain error in this case. It was not raised at the trial court level. And because this court never specifically stated that the court is prohibited from relying on a statutorily authorized affidavit, that is part of the record. It wasn't submitted as an exhibit necessary at the hearing, but already part of the record. Since that was not part of the Willis decision, that the plain error rule apply, and because Mr. Sargent did not raise it at the hearing, that he waived that right to contest that now on appeal. And the same would apply for the right of confrontation. And so, unless there's further questions, I will rest my argument.
No further questions, Mr. Olson. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Lawler, any rebuttal? Ms. Lawler, are you out there?
Can you see me now?
There we go.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm very sorry. I've just been talking to myself.
Okay. Well, your 5 minutes will start now.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just going to offer a very brief rebuttal. I don't think now, at this point, following the argument that the state is disputing that Mr. Sargent never admitted to stealing a car or to damaging a car. I don't think it's denying that the record going into the restitution hearing did not ever establish that Mr. Sargent had taken anyone's property but Mr. Haglund's. At pages 13 and 14 of the plea agreement, he admitted to taking Mr. Haglund's personal property. In her request for restitution, Ms. Panger filed an affidavit in which she states that the following losses were incurred, but never claims that the losses were incurred by her. And so this appears to be an example in which a grandmother is standing in for her living adult son trying to seek damages for property that he may have lost. The problem is, though, that then when the state bears the burden of proving that a certain victim incurred certain losses for crimes for which they were committed, the state didn't meet its burden. It didn't meet its burden under Boettcher that Mr. Sargent ever stole a car or damaged it. And it didn't meet its burden under Willis or its progeny that it needed to prove in a trial-like confrontation that this was the victim and that she bore those particular losses caused by Mr. Sargent.
Let me ask you this question. Your remedy that you're requesting is that we just outright reverse. Why wouldn't we remand it for the proper proceeding?
I think in light of Boettcher that would be appropriate, Your Honor. In light of the Boettcher decision of this last week, it made clear that in these types of situations, the proper remedy is a reversal and remand. And it actually addressed that more detailed language than is the norm. I think in light of that decision and that guidance from just this past week, that it would be appropriate to reverse and remand. Unless the court has any additional questions, we would ask for that reversal and remand on both of those independent grounds.
Thank you, Ms. Lawler. Mr. Olson, the matter will be taken under advisement. An opinion will issue in 90 days.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.